Good morning and welcome. Welcome to the slippery slope of lipids and other medical conditions. It's time to open the phone lines up and have you join our live radio talk show with Dr. Elizabeth Triana from the Triana Prevention Center in Port Charlotte, Florida. Phone lines are open at 206-1580 in the 941 area code or 888-441-1580. And you're welcome to join the conversation at any point to ask questions or for offer comments or share experiences. And now, here's your host of the show, Dr. Elizabeth Triana. Good morning.
Good morning.
And welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning. Happy New Year, everyone.
It's been a interesting month or so, in and out, and Jen's been filling in for you and doing a wonderful job. In case you don't know, she's been doing a wonderful job.
Oh, I know she has. I've heard she's doing a great job. And as you know, this is going to be our first show that's an hour.
New format starting today.
New format. We're going to have a lot of really interesting guests and segments. Mm-hmm. And Jennifer's going to be working with us, too. She's so good. Mm-hmm. And all kinds of just interesting things that I want everyone to listen into. And of course, if you have a question, please call in. As Todd said, 206-1580. So I'm going to start off by saying that we have a guest, but I will say, tell you where I've been doing and what's been happening. I have been to an incredible medical conference in Miami at the Fontainebleau. Mm-hmm. You know, that place is iconic.
Sort of is. It goes way back.
It's just gorgeous. The conference was the ISET conference, and it's the International Society of Endovascular Therapy. And I'm going to be giving information about that, and I'll tell you, it was so exciting. When you see somebody coming in with a stroke and they go and they suck the clot right out of the brain so the person doesn't have any after effects, it's so wonderful.
That sounds science fiction, really.
No. This is real, though. This is real.
Wow.
Great conference. I also had the pleasure of speaking for the Floridian Club and on women's health. Mm-hmm. I must have had about 60 women that I spoke to. And that was fun and interesting. And tomorrow, I am going to, I was asked to be a model for the Arts and Humanity Council for Alzheimer's disease.
A model, huh?
Yes. I can't believe that. But
well, I think it's terrific. We've not only got an educated and interesting doctor to listen to, but a fashion model in the house. That's
nice. Oh, yes. And it's going to be lady doctors are going to be the fashion model. But, you know, there's so many patients who have Alzheimer's. And I just think it's really anything I can do to contribute. And it'll be fun. Mm-hmm. So I am so excited today. I have not only a great guest, but a great friend. Carol Katz is a friend of mine and her husband, Brian, who are two incredible people. I think Brian actually would be a wonderful guest, too. I'm going to say it on the air. Okay, I hope he's listening. I think he would. He's an incredible person. And Carol is too. Carol is a psychotherapist. Mm-hmm. She is an addiction specialist. She is an artist. Her paintings, I've got to say, are so beautiful. She's very intelligent, but not just that. She has the spiritual. She appreciates nature. She has over 20 years experience. Now I'm talking about you, Carol, how the wonderful things.
Keep going. It sounds good.
And she's a world traveler. She's even been to India and lived in India. So I'm very excited to introduce Carol today. And so I'm going to start off with a really important question. What led you to become an addiction specialist? Tell me about yourself.
Well, actually, for me, by the way, good to be here.
Thank you.
Great environment. Nice to meet you, Todd.
Nice to meet you.
Betsy, it's great to be on your show. I'm very excited about this. And it's always good talking about addictions because it's an important thing that affects many people in many ways. not only the person who has an abuse or addiction problem, but also the family members that are affected by addiction. And many times we forget about them. But I will start with saying that for many years, I was actually a legal secretary for almost 20 years.
Oh, so you have a great background. That's right. You told me that.
But I always wanted to be a social worker or do social work, counseling. And because my lifestyle for many years was very nomadic, I didn't really sit in one place long enough to get my education until probably my mid-30s. And at that point, I went back to college.
Wow.
And I wound up getting my master's. And I got it in counseling with my specialty as addictions. And
that's wonderful that you even went back to school later in life. And I think that's even harder, actually.
Well, it was interesting because I was working full-time as a legal secretary, and I wound up going back to school to the university full-time. And in a way, it was actually easier because I was taking all the courses that I was really interested in.
Okay.
I mean, not all of them, because you have to take biology and mathematics. And
my favorite. I love biology.
So, and I was also in the curriculum I was in, there were a lot of people more my age than people just coming out of high school. So there was a lot of camaraderie, and it was great. So I wound up getting my master's in counseling and addictions as my specialty, and also getting certified in New York and in Florida as an addictions professional. And that was over 20 years ago.
Wow.
So I've been in private practice in New York for many years now, and I did work originally in different treatment modalities. Inpatient, intensive outpatient, detox. And then finally, I just went into private practice, which I've been in probably for, I'm going to say about 13 years.
Good.
And it was kind of like a stepping stone because I went back to school just to take some psychology classes and just kept in addictions and knew a lot of people throughout my life that suffered with addiction, that died of addiction, and also died of other diseases related to addiction, such as AIDS. And just, you know, I wanted to help people in that field.
That's really great because anytime you deal when people have problems, you have to have a calmness about you, which you do have, to be able to help that person through that. So I guess one of my questions would be, how does somebody know they're addicted to something? What does it mean to be addicted?
Well, addiction is when you have a chronic compulsive behavior that in time, you build tolerance to that. If you abstain from it, many times there are withdrawal symptoms. And also, you can't stop the behavior in spite of having adverse negative effects in your life by indulging in it.
Okay.
So let's say someone, as an example, has diabetes and they can't have sweets, but they continue to have sweets. That creates a situation where it can jeopardize their health.
And their life.
And their life. So same thing with addiction, where it's a real chronic compulsive behavior, whether it's dependent on a substance or a non-substance, such as gambling.
That's right.
Gambling is a non-substance addiction. A person, people are codependent. They're addicted to another person, which can create a lot of harm in their life. Mm-hmm. So not every addiction is a substance addiction that we ingest. And the consequences, the behavioral pattern has in one's life many times with abuse or addiction is very negative. And, you know, no one starts off wanting to get addicted. But when you take in a substance that is addictive and you do it enough, you're going to become addicted.
Right.
And then, you know, a lot of people don't realize they've crossed over that line into addiction until it starts having adverse effects in their life, whether mm-hmm. their health, their job, their family relationships, love relationships. And I don't know, did I say health?
Health
is a big thing.
Well, I know there's even some people who are addicted to shopping.
Oh, absolutely. Shopping,
and
gambling.
They run the credit cards up to That's the max right. mm-hmm. and get more credit cards to Sex. Shop more.
Sex is a big addiction that's often overlooked, even when people come in for a substance abuse or alcoholism. A lot of times sexual addiction is a big part of people's lives that is unrecognized, or you know, a lot of times it's not even part of the assessment when someone comes in.
So if I can ask, I'm just sure. curious, it sounds as if what you're saying is oftentimes addictions can be multi-layered and it's not
yes.
maybe just one particular thing.
Correct. Many people have multiple addictions. So they could have an addiction to alcohol and sweets, sugar, because a lot of times also when people who are alcoholic now abstain from alcohol, because alcohol produces so much body, it's metabolized into sugar in the
right.
body, that they begin to crave sugar. So they're not drinking, but now they're taking in an abundance of sugar products.
Mm-hmm. Sweets.
So, and many times people will drink and do drugs.
Well, you hear some people say, like I've had patients, the patient will say they have an addictive personality.
Mm-hmm.
Is there
mm-hmm.
such a thing?
Yes, absolutely.
There is.
Yes, I think a lot of times people will replace addictions. As we just said, alcohol, sugar is one example of it. A lot of times people don't have it's almost like a shutoff valve where you indulge in a behavior
mm-hmm.
socially, let's say. But then again, they cross that line where they can't control their behavior. They can't just stop at two drinks. They can't just stop at one cookie or two cookies. So the compulsiveness in their personality helps to create addiction. And when one is stopped, it's replaced by another. Primarily, when one abstains from their primary addiction, if they're not treated
okay.
for it professionally, then it's almost like a dry drunk. You can stop drinking, but what created the alcohol problem or any other abuse or addiction problem, if that's not treated, you're still the same person.
Yes, I understand.
You're not growing and changing
right.
to really work on replacing old behaviors with new behaviors, healthier behaviors.
Right. It's just like the person, you know, you may, like they say, once an alcoholic is always... Theoretically, if they always crave for that, like people will tell me, I have high blood pressure. I'll say, well, you have high blood pressure. And they say, no, I don't. I said, well, you're on blood pressure medicine. It's controlled, but you still have the underlining condition of high blood pressure. Right now, we have it under treat. You know, it's treated. It's under control. So I would think that's the same with addictions also.
Yes, and many times people will be in recovery, whether it's with a professional in treatment or a 12-step program, or hopefully a combination of the two is really ideal. And they may be abstinent from their drug of choice. And I'm going to say drug as really anything they're addicted to, whether it's a substance or non-substance addiction.
Right.
So if they're abstinent from their drug of choice, they may think after a period of time, well, you know, maybe I really wasn't addicted, because here, you know, I've gone 3 months, or I've gone a year or 5 years, which, by the way, are big relapse time periods.
Oh.
3 months, a year, and 5 years are big time, are big periods of time where people typically will relapse or can relapse. Not that everybody does, of course.
Right.
But after 3 months, someone in early treatment or recovery will say, well, it's been 3 months, I haven't, you know, had a drink, then maybe I really didn't have such a bad problem. It's kind of like this built-in forgetter.
Right.
So they'll drink. Or many times people will relapse on a drug that's not their drug of choice, because they'll think, well, I know I had a problem with alcohol, but I never had a problem with cocaine or marijuana or pills. And they'll try that. And maybe for a little while they'll stay with that. But ultimately, they want their drug of choice. Just like, you know, if you gave me white cake, I'm going to maybe eat it, because I know if I have chocolate cake, I'm really going to indulge in that chocolate cake. So I may stick with the white cake for a little bit, and then I'm going to say, oh, God, the heck with it. I'm going for what I really want.
The good stuff.
The
chocolate
good stuff.
Cake.
Exactly. So someone who's maybe smoking pot or using cocaine because they know they can't drink, at some point they will go back to their drug of choice of alcohol or whatever their drug of choice is. And many times even indulge in it more deeply than where they left off. It's almost like making up for time, and the body craves it even more. Just like if someone gives up smoking cigarettes.
Which is the hardest thing. I have so many patients.
Cigarettes.
Excuse me. Cigarettes. Oh, we have a caller.
Hi, caller. You're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, caller. How can we help you?
Yes, I'd like to try and ask the question of how can I differentiate in my particular case whether I am a social drinker or I am addicted to the alcohol?
That's an excellent question.
That is a great question, caller. Thank you so much for calling.
You want to hang up and then listen to the answer?
You want me to hang up now?
That is a great question, caller.
Because I can hear your radio in the background, so I'm thinking it might be easy for you to hear.
Okay, I'll hear it on the radio.
Thank you so much. And I'm sure that this is a question you've heard many times before.
Yes. That's a great question. I'll defer that to you. That's a great.
Okay. So the thing is, if a person doesn't think they have a problem, let's say, with alcohol, they don't think, they're in denial, let's say, but they really do have a problem with alcohol, it's causing adverse effects in their life, then many times if they come to me for treatment, whether they're pressured by a family member or their job, whatever, I'll say to them, okay, well, since you don't think you have a problem with alcohol, why don't you not drink for the next week until we see each other again? Because if you don't have a problem, it shouldn't be difficult not to drink for a week.
Okay.
And they'll say, oh, sure, I could do that. And then we'll meet in a week, and I'll say, okay, so how did you do? And they'll say, well, you know, after 3 days, I didn't think it was a big deal. I had a drink. Okay. So then in that case, they see for themselves they can't abstain for the week, which isn't a real long period of time unless you have a real dependency on something.
Mm-hmm.
So the social drinker won't have a problem giving it up for a week. And also, if someone is a social drinker, drinking will not cause difficulties in their life. It won't keep them out of work.
Oh.
typically it won't cause relationship problems. It won't cause health problems. They can stop after a couple of drinks. They won't have to have three or four or five. A lot of times people who have an alcohol problem, as an example, may go out drinking socially or go out for dinner and say to themselves, well, I'm just going to have a couple of two drinks tonight.
Mm-hmm.
Or their spouse may say to them, honey, please, just have a couple of drinks.
Take it easy tonight.
Take it easy tonight. And they won't be able to.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll leave the restaurant or the bar after five or six drinks. Or say to themselves, oh, honey, I'm just, say to their significant other, I'm just stopping at the bar for a couple of drinks to meet with the guys. And then half the evening goes by and they're still not home. And then they're driving home and they're intoxicated. And many times people think when they're intoxicated that they drive even better.
Yes. I'm so much more careful.
Yes.
Yes.
Right. And I don't swerve. But the thing is, when a person is intoxicated on whatever drug they're on, their judgment is greatly reduced.
Right.
Their coordination is greatly reduced. So even though they think they're in control and they can drive better, if you ever saw someone on the road driving that was intoxicated, you know that person's intoxicated.
It's been proven time and time again. It's
right.
And oftentimes, unfortunately, they're not the ones hurt, but they hurt others or kill others. Mm-hmm. So the I think legally, you can have one drink every hour in, I believe it's every hour in 10 or 15 minutes for it to metabolize in your body so that you can now drive safely.
I've never heard it put that way before.
Mm-hmm. Well, and if you drink more than that and let's say get stopped, then your blood alcohol level will be above the legal limits.
And so, I'm sure that might be the average person, but some people, if they're older, if their liver's not working well, it may less would be intoxicate.
Yeah, please don't say I heard on the radio, so it's okay.
Right. Right. And also, women metabolize alcohol a lot different than men, as well as body frames. The larger you are, you may metabolize alcohol quicker.
Also, what other medications you're on affects the metabolism. People don't realize that all the medicines you take are going to affect how everything else in your body gets metabolized. So I think that's really important. I did read an article about young women, especially when they go out and they do really heavy binge drinking, is also considered a form of alcoholism.
Good point.
Where they have big, big binges and almost and well, can't stop that on the weekends.
There is a type of alcoholism that's referred to as episodic alcoholism.
Okay.
And that's where someone doesn't necessarily drink every day. They may even only drink once a month. But when they drink, they get drunk, really drunk.
They drink with a purpose.
They drink with a purpose. Or sometimes they may not even have that as their goal, but they only drink once a month. They they allow themselves that. And they may begin drinking thinking, oh, well, you know, this is my once a month drinking episode and I'm going to have a few. But then they get really, really drunk. And they may drink it off over the weekend and think, well, it's not a problem. It's not affecting my job. It's not affecting my health. But it is, because actually drinking like that creates more of a shock to the system. So the poison of alcohol is even greater. And I want to say that I know a lot of people think that addiction and alcoholism, they associate a lot of stigma with it, with someone having that as a problem. And a lot of times people don't want to speak about it. Speak about whether they have a problem with it or not, or maybe a loved one has a problem with it and the other person doesn't know who to speak to about how to help themselves or how to help the other person. So this is an opportunity to call in to ask questions you may have about that. because a lot of times family members don't know how to deal with the person who has an abuse or an addiction problem.
Let me throw in just my situation quickly, because it might be something that along those lines people can relate to, because I was in a previous relationship with somebody who we have described almost every step of this conversation, right down to the right down to getting the 3-month chip and then falling off the wagon. Okay. Exactly. So I know exactly. And I got the biggest benefit out of getting involved with Narinon. And that helped me as a family member. In this case, it was a spouse, but nonetheless, that helped me understand my role in it, what I could and couldn't do.
So let me just describe Narinon.
What is it?
Narinon is a 12-step program like Narcotics Anonymous, like Alcoholics Anonymous, which also has Al-Anon. And the Anon programs, which are 12-step related programs, are for family members, loved ones, friends, coworkers that have someone in their life that has an abuse or an addiction problem that needs support themselves and understanding to the situation, how to live with it, how to deal with it. So if you're not seeking professional help, which I recommend always in addition to any 12-step program you may be in, to get support and to get help and to realize that you're not alone in that situation, because many people feel very isolated. They're afraid to talk about it with other people, with friends, to say, you know, my husband really is addicted to pills or cocaine or whatever the addiction is, because more and more people are becoming addicted to prescription pills, and it's a very serious
serious
problem in this country.
I think that was the biggest thing for me, was to be immersed in an environment where everybody there understood, because they're going through the same thing.
Exactly.
You don't find that in the general public, and it's something that isolates you from the people that you used to rely on for support. I had to turn my back on my family and my close friends in order to support the person I was with, and then I had nobody, so it was really important.
That would be, it's really good that at that time of your life you knew to seek out that help.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've heard of Al-Anon, but I didn't know that with narcotics, too.
Yeah, there's Narinon. There's also Gammonon for people who have someone in their life that is a gambler. And the person in your life with an abuse or addiction problem doesn't themselves have to be in a 12-step program or even seeking professional help for you to attend these meetings.
In fact, more
often
than not.
Because they're for you. More often than not, they're not seeking help.
They're refusing to, and that's contributing to your problems.
And also, there's a process of intervention. I've done many interventions in my career where it's a very orchestrated, detailed process.
With the whole family?
With the family, friends, coworkers, sometimes a priest or a minister, a rabbi, you know, or a spiritual mentor in the family would also be involved to get the person into treatment that is really refusing to. So it's a great process for in that situation.
Well, you know, one of the things is, you know, January, everybody makes resolutions. And it seems like a lot of people break their resolutions within the first week. Is it, you know, and some of them are related to addictions then?
Yes. Well, you know, people basically want to be healthy. They want to have good relationships. They don't want their addiction controlling their life. And so, you know, many times I'll get calls from people really sounding serious about wanting help, wanting treatment, making an appointment, wanting an assessment. And then it comes time for that appointment and they don't show up.
Oh, my goodness.
Okay. So initially, their intention is good, just like when we make New Year's resolutions. Our intentions are good. We know this is something we need to do. We need it and we want it. And we have hope about ourselves for doing it. But then what happens? You know, we slowly weaken in a sense, to what has been our behavioral pattern for so long. You can't just stop. Well, I take that back. You can just stop with difficulty, but with help, a pattern of behavior that you've been indulging in for a long period of time. People need help. It's very difficult to change without professional help. It's very difficult. And a lot of times people will say, well, what do I need to come to you for? I could do this on my own. You know, I don't need to go into treatment and hear those lectures. Mm-hmm. And I often use the analogy of, well, you know, if I wanted to be a really good carpenter, then maybe I could learn that on my own in time.
Right.
Or I could take some courses and learn from a professional or a master that has
the skills.
The skills, exactly, and has the techniques to show me. So do I want to learn from someone who knows what they're talking about, or do I want to kind of, you know, try and get out of the quicksand myself?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of times people want to get out of the quicksand themselves, and they just keep sinking because they need to reach their hand out,
right,
to have someone else grab it to help them. And, you know, there's a saying that, I didn't quit, I surrendered. And that's a really significant quote.
That's pretty big.
Because a lot of times with New Year's resolutions, we want to quit,
right,
whatever it is. Mm-hmm. I want to quit my sweets. I want to quit, you know, being lazy.
I want to lose weight.
Right. I want to lose weight.
So sure.
I want to quit eating so much.
Food addiction is another one. Sure.
I want to start exercising more.
Right. I want to quit sitting on the couch and get up with those dumbbells, mm-hmm, whatever it is. So, again, we have good intentions. But we're quitting. Okay. Now, what does that mean? I didn't quit. I surrendered. So when I surrender to something, I'm really accepting on a deeper level that I have a problem with this. I'm surrendering to the problem. Okay. I'm not holding, when we have an abuse or addiction problem, that has control over us. We don't have control over it. So to say I'm quitting, I'm going away from that problem on my own is so difficult because the problem has power over us.
Yeah, you're like giving up. If you surrender.
If you surrender, then you're saying, and again, I use as an example, if I'm on a battlefield and I'm being destroyed on this battlefield, which addiction is a battlefield, if I'm being destroyed on this battlefield, And my loved ones are on the perimeter of the field saying, come on back, get out of there. And I say, no, I can do this. I can win this war. But I'm getting destroyed on the battlefield. And they keep calling me, come back. Then at some point, I'm really either going to get very beaten up or I'm going to get killed. And that's what addiction does. It beats us up in a person's life, or it kills them. And to get off the battlefield and to hold up a flag and say, okay, I surrender. I'm not indulging in this war anymore. I can't win it. I surrender. And I turn around, I get off the battlefield. Then I'm walking toward recovery. I'm walking toward helping myself.
And getting help.
And getting help. It's not just, you know, I'm staying on the battlefield, but I quit. No. It doesn't work that way. So they turn around, they're surrendering to the battle of addiction.
It's sort of an admission of my powerlessness to compete against it. I'm not going to compete anymore.
Right.
And that's why an alcoholic will tell you after 50 years of sobriety, I'm an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. Is the way I've always understood it. We do have a caller here. Hi, caller, you're on the air.
I called before, and
yes.
I have a follow-up question.
Okay.
And the question is, how do I go about having care in my problems without the community or where I work knowing about it?
Okay.
Did you hear that?
That's a good question.
I think I heard the question.
He's asking how can he avoid having people know that he is getting help for a problem.
Okay.
Thank you, caller. Thank you so much for calling. We really appreciate that.
Well, I think that the best way would be to find a professional who is in private practice rather than working in a clinic. Because not that clinics aren't good, but if you're really concerned about your anonymity and your confidentiality, then you want to go to someone who's in private practice. So when you walk through the doors, it's you and just them. And by law, an addictions professional particularly really has to keep your confidentiality. Because if I break someone's confidentiality, then I have the chance of losing everything.
Right. Well, all of us as doctors, as correct. Mental health professionals,
right.
the confidentiality.
So I would suggest seeking a professional, whether it's on the internet. A lot of my referrals come from the internet because there you can see a person's experience. Sometimes they have anonymous reviews by people. That have seen that professional. And sometimes you have to go through an interviewing process because someone could have great credentials and sound and look really good on paper. But yet when you go to them, you're really not clicking or you really don't have a rapport with them. And I think that's very important to have. So you may have to go through a couple of people. And I know a lot of times people will... that do connect with me and feel a rapport with me, also that have been to other professionals, will often say to me that the spiritual part of who I am,
yes,
that I bring into play in treatment with patients, is a big piece for them. Because I believe personally, that the root of addiction for most people is a spiritual void. And a lot of people don't relate to that, particularly at the beginning. In time, if they are abstinent from their drug of choice, they begin to see more and more how that can be. So if I'm feeling a void inside of myself, which I call the spiritual void, but we could just say void, if I'm feeling a void inside of myself, then I want to fill that void because it kind of feels like a hole inside. I want to fill it. So how do I fill it? If I don't have...
You want to feel better.
I want to feel better.
Yes.
So if I don't have a spiritual basis in my life, which is really an inner job, inner work, then I have to fill it from the outside in. And to fill an inner void from the outside is delusion and an illusion because it doesn't work. Maybe momentarily you could buy something and feel, oh, yes, and happy.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, in 30 minutes it's gone and there you
or
are
eat a
feeling
piece of
empty.
Candy or chocolate cake or
anything.
A drink.
Whatever
or
it is.
Gamble or
whatever you're taking from the outside to fill inside.
Only a moment.
Doesn't work. It's very temporary. Whereas if you're on a spiritual or religious path and you're filling yourself, truly filling yourself from the inside out, then that's more permanent. That's what stays with you.
Right.
And that's who kind of infiltrates into the rest of your life. So you can fill an inner void with anything outside, but most people don't know that. So we're constantly putting stuff into ourselves or around ourselves. We fill ourselves with materialism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we want to just surround ourselves or take from the outside in to fill that inner void. And it's very temporary.
I will tell you that, and this is my own personal experience only, that I got to Naranon by beginning to become involved with a local church-based recovery group. And mm-hmm. one f- foot led to another, and then I ended up getting exactly what I needed to have done. But so I understand exactly what you're talking about. And mm-hmm. it's something that I do recommend and actually still continue to volunteer and work with.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. I think so. The bottom, I try to make things into little pearls, you know, what's easy for people to remember. But there's hope. There's hope for people who have these problems. And your recommendation, when you look at a patient, as I do, I look at the total being. Mm-hmm. And you're just saying it's not just the addiction, it's the spiritual part too.
Mm-hmm.
Am I correct?
Yes, absolutely.
So, you know, and I agree with you too that a lot of times you'll find either a doctor or specialist that they may have all their credentials, but you, like you said, you find that you clicked with that person and mm-hmm. you have a rapport, and that is already the basis for the beginning for the person to move in the direction of either getting healthier, understanding what the problem is, trusting you, believing mm-hmm. in you as the specialist.
Right.
So, I mean, I think what you said is so important.
I think trust is important to feel comfortable with someone.
And I think it gets back to what the caller kind of started this conversation. He was asking about how can he go about getting help without it being something that becomes community knowledge.
Right. Because in 12-step program, or even if you go for treatment in a clinic and there are a lot of other people around, the professionals are bound by confidentiality.
Mm-hmm.
But the people attending those different mm-hmm. formats are not bound by anything.
Everybody pledges to keep it within, but
right.
like you say, there's
but
no
people
obligation.
Gossip.
Sure, sure.
And, you know, the thing is, too, though, that let's say, as an example, a person that's an alcoholic. Chances are, unless you're living, you know, in a big city, people around you are going to know you have a problem. It's difficult to hide addiction mm-hmm. problems. And so people don't think about that very often. They think, well, you know, if I go for treatment, if someone sees me going into a meeting, an AA meeting, let's say, then if someone sees me going, then, you know, everyone's going to know. But the thing is, most people or many people will know anyway if you have a problem. So
isn't there a fallacy that if I have a problem, but I go through my day, I work, I take care of my family, I do the things I need to do. It's kind of like being a functioning addict that nobody knows then, right? But that's
right.
usually not true.
And that's one of the biggest denial points is because when someone has an addiction problem, often the last thing to go is their job.
Mm. Mm.
Oh.
They will, you know, their health may be failing. Their family relationships or love relationships may be failing. But they can keep it together at work. So if they can keep it together at work, then they're not that bad.
Mm. And they get good at it, too, quite
yeah.
frankly.
Oh, yeah.
At the coping skills of balancing
and many
that.
Times they'll bring in, let's say, a spouse to cover for them.
Oh, sure. I've done that
and,
before.
Yeah. It's like, oh, you know, Todd has the flu mm-hmm. today. He can't. Typically, it's on a Monday.
Mm-hmm.
Many people call in on Mondays because sure. they're just so hungover from the
exactly.
weekend.
Exactly. And you think you're helping in doing it.
Right.
In there.
From I know our time is running out, but just on a more practical sense, in terms of like cigarette smoking, do you have any recommendations or tips? I mean, I've seen patients have smoke through tracheostomy
mm-hmm,
tubes and
mm-hmm.
or take off their oxygen and smoke and they can barely breathe.
Right.
But I don't even want to get to that extreme point. Just the person, let's say a 50-some-year-old who's already smoked for 10 or 20 years, do you have any?
Well, I can say that nicotine is a very powerful addictive drug.
Right.
Very powerful. And because most people that do smoke cigarettes have the repetitive behavior. Remember, the behavior is also addictive. People think that, oh, I'm really tense. I have to have a cigarette. But cigarettes themselves have so much stimulants in them. So it's a fallacy to think I'm having a cigarette to relax. It's the behavior of taking the cigarette, lighting the cigarette, inhaling, the routine and behavior of smoking that's relaxing for them. But cigarettes themselves are stimulants. Nicotine is a powerful stimulant, just like caffeine, but much more powerful. So it's the behavioral pattern and the repetitiveness. You know, people that really are addicted to cigarettes, they may be having a cigarette every 15 or 20 minutes. So it's breaking the behavior also. So there are things people do to lessen or stop cigarette smoking, which we know there are patches. There's right. gum people can chew. If they don't want to go that route, one of the suggestions I give people, not only with cigarettes, but often with cigarettes, is when you feel like having a cigarette, wait 10 minutes.
Okay.
Just 10 minutes. And then have the cigarette. So if you keep waiting that 10 minutes, you will begin to smoke less and less. And sometimes after 10 minutes, maybe you get involved in something else. And now it's been 20 minutes. So it's a form of harm reduction. I am reducing the harm of cigarettes by just putting it off a little bit and a little bit.
Okay. Well, what about with food? Because so many people, that's another thing, the diets. You know, everyone has their diet resolution.
Mm-hmm. Including myself.
Including myself, too.
So, again, you know.
Because you have to eat food to live.
You have to eat food, but, you know, there's healthy food, there's fattening food, there's unhealthy food, there's healthy food that's not fattening. You know, we have choices.
Yes.
And we have the power over our choices. And a lot of times it's really having the conviction of commitment. And I think that...
Is that the same as willpower?
No, because I think willpower is more of the I quit rather than I surrendered.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. Willpower is I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to do this. I can do this. You know, it's that quitting. I'm quitting carrot cake. Okay. Whatever it is. I'm quitting. That's like my willpower. But when you have a commitment to the conviction, it's more like I surrendered, that I really have a problem, let's say, with this particular type of food. If I want to lose weight, I can't have that type of food. I know that. I'm surrendering to the fact I cannot have this type of food. And again, why am I eating this type of food? Why am I indulging in stuff that is not healthy for me? What am I feeling? What void am I feeling inside with right. this food that I know is unhealthy for me? This is part of the addiction.
Right.
If I'm taking in a substance that I know is not healthy for me, that has adverse effects on my health, then I have to look at that. Why am I doing that? You know, why don't I care about me enough to take care of myself?
That's very good. And I.
So it's filling the void again with something from the outside in. And it doesn't work that way. I have to look at what is the void. That's a big step. What is the void that I'm trying to fill from the outside?
Just to follow up on where you started this part of the conversation with regard to smoking.
Right.
So you said there are pills nowadays, there are patches, there's gum. But it sounds to me like you're also saying that's probably not going to be enough. You need to actually interact with somebody, talk with somebody, have a therapist perhaps even help you.
Well, I think therapy is a good modality for a lot of people.
Even just for smoking.
The thing is that unless someone's health is being adversely affected by smoking, mm-hmm. they're not going to see their life as unmanageable.
Right.
Like, let's say someone who has an alcohol or substance abuse problem. Mm-hmm. Well, it doesn't interfere with anything. Mm-hmm. You know, I can smoke, so I can go outside from work. I don't lose time at work because I'm smoking. It doesn't affect my driving. Doesn't affect my marriage.
Right, right.
So the denial of it is greater. But until it, you know, if you want it to begin to affect your health. When I was 15, I started smoking cigarettes. At 22, I stopped because I developed asthma. You know, in 6 or 7 years, I developed asthma.
That's the thing. It affects your health so critically.
So if patches or gum is not enough. And again, it's all about commitment. Do I really want to stop? I had a father who had half his leg amputated because he had poor circulation. And he had a bad diet and he smoked. And he kept smoking. Mm-hmm. He hid it because he knew we'd kill him.
Well, how often have we seen it? And I know you're the medical professionals, but even I've seen people on oxygen with emphysema who remove the mask to smoke.
Right. Yes. So it's a very powerful, just physiologically, nicotine is a very powerful drug. Aside from all the drugs, I think they add over 200 chemicals to cigarettes, to tobacco.
Do you have a website that you recommend or anything? Because we always like to, I always like to leave homework for my patients, you know. go to this website.
I don't have a website, but if people want to contact or want to make an appointment, they can reach me at an email to present an email, leaving their phone number. And my email is S as in Sam, EAPURPLE 18@yahoo.com. So that's CPURPLE18@yahoo.com. My name is Carol Katz. And if you have any questions, I'd be glad to help you with them.
Really appreciate that. You've been such a wonderful guest. Not only she's a wonderful guest, I mean, literally, we could spend another 2 hours here. Mm-hmm. And I know our time is running out, but it's been really great. And I always feel what we do on this program is that we do change lives.
Yeah.
And this is a big community issue, too. So it's good to keep talking about this.
And there's very few people you'll meet that don't have addiction affecting their life in one way or another. So feel free to send an email. And I also do Skype and phone sessions. I am from New York, but I do spend many months here in Florida.
Will you give that email address again? Because I'm sure somebody was scrambling for a pencil.
Okay. It's S as in Sam, E-A, P as in Peter, U-R-P-L-E 18@yahoo.com.
Okay.
Feel free to send in your question and a phone number if you want me to call you.
And remember, this is the Dr. Elizabeth Triana, and we're here with Carol Katz, Todd, and at the Triana Prevention Center, we're here to help you to stay healthy and tune in because every Friday we're going to have a great program just like today's.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
It's been great.
WCCF Punta Gorda.
News Radio 1580.
Charlotte County's only news talk radio station serving you around the clock.